And please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Nora from the Meditating Misfits. Hi, I'm Nora. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for being here tonight, guys. I know the weather's less than wonderful. I was actually sitting in my car and I was looking at the weather and it's like was raining sideways before I came in between the wind and the rain. And I'm sitting in my car and I'm like, I'll just wait till it lets up. And I'm sitting there and it's getting worse and worse. And I'm like, oh, it'll let up. It'll let up. And that's a really good metaphor, I think, for a lot of things in this program. You know, being alcoholics, having a really high tolerance for pain and for suffering and making excuses instead of like accepting like, hey, I might be uncomfortable in this moment, but if I take that little bit of action, you know, there's something so much better on the other side. Thinking about like getting sober and waiting for the right time or right conditions to stop, or, you know, the excuses that we make of like why we can't get sober, why you can't go to treatment at a certain point. But it just continues to get worse and get worse out there. And then being in the program, waiting to get a sponsor, waiting to go through the steps, waiting to go work with a newcomer, and just depriving yourself of that experience because you're anticipating any amount of discomfort. And so I finally had to jump in, go get my feet wet in the puddles. And lo and behold, my feet are dry within 10 minutes and I'm fine and I'm among friends, but there's just that initial perception of any discomfort and I balk, like the steps talk about. So that was an interesting thing to see, you know, before I walked in and just to be reminded of, you know, sometimes there's that little bit of discomfort and I can balk. And, you know, if I continue to do that, I'll never move. I'll never change my circumstances. I'll stay stuck where I'm at. And that's not something I can afford to do. You know, I know what it's like to be stuck prior to getting sober and even in sobriety, to be stuck and to be stagnant. And it's a painful place to be. My sobriety date is December 26, 2013. It was a very interesting Christmas that year, as I'm sure you can imagine. I grew up in a big Irish Catholic family. My parents are not alcoholics. They're the kind of people who my dad drinks half a beer and pours the rest down the sink. Very foreign to me. My mother had two alcoholic, abusive parents, grew up in a pretty tough household. A lot of her siblings drank the way that I drank. I can't make a decision for them what that means, but my mom, God bless her, did not drink growing up. And from an early age, my parents had some pretty strict rules about alcohol. It wasn't in the house. It wasn't accessible to me. It was this taboo. So alcohol really wasn't on my radar. But one of the things we learn when we come in this program is that alcohol, liquor, it's a symptom. It's a symptom of a bigger spiritual sickness. And when I look back in my history, that spiritual sickness started long before I picked up the first drink. You know, that feeling of being different, that feeling of being apart from the terminal uniqueness that this program talks about. I was adamant as a kid that I must have been adopted because I felt so out of place with my own family. I just could never be comfortable in my own skin. And I do share as well that I've dealt with mental health issues. You know, it's an outside issue that I benefit from outside help to manage, but sobriety is an integral component for me for taking care of my mental health. And similarly, taking care of my mental health for my sobriety. You know, they tell us, those of us with grave and emotional mental disorders do recover. We have the capacity to be honest with ourselves. And as I'll tell you, it took me a while to do that. It took a while for me to be honest with myself, to be honest with medical professionals who already knew what I wasn't telling them. But it took those things in order for me to find sobriety at a lasting way. So I'm dealing with myself. I'm dealing with, you know, being sick in self, being feared up, terminal uniqueness, just full of fear. I think fear was my first drug or drink of choice in my emotional drugstore. You know, if I wasn't actively fearful, I was looking for it. It just kind of became my default mode, like my comfortable, like a car alarm that's going off for so long, it becomes part of your environment. Like if you hear a clock ticking all the time, you stop hearing the ticking. The fear was just that default mode constantly being charged up. not even realizing that I wanted or needed relief from it because it became my default mode. And as I was getting older and I could see my peers and my friends like seeming to do things with impunity, seeming to go out, have fun, socialize, dating, I needed something. I needed something to make it stop. I needed something to just be what I thought other people wanted me to be. I was trying to find myself in relationships. I was trying to find myself or distract myself with self-harm. And when I found alcohol, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Alcohol made things get quiet. It felt like I could finally breathe. Like I could take my head out, wring it out like it was a dirty rag and just get a fresh, clean start. I loved that I discovered I could black out. That instantly became my result every time I drank. I wanted to black out. I didn't see the purpose in drinking and not blacking out. And I went on like that for a while. I couldn't get alcohol as much as I would have liked. It wasn't readily accessible in my childhood home. But again, I was trying to act out in any number of ways that I could. And I would have that appearance on the surface that I looked okay. I was making okay grades. I was an athlete. But inside, I was still that feared up little girl, you know, just desperate for acceptance, just desperate to be a part of, just desperate to feel okay in my own skin. And I never felt okay. And I went off to college. And for me, you know, I was the female alcoholic gone beyond recall within a matter of years. It was like the roller coaster started when it came to my drinking. All of a sudden, I could get alcohol anytime I wanted. People were drinking around me constantly. And I had it in my head, you know, being a disease of perception, I had it in my head that other people were drinking the same way I was drinking. I didn't put two and two together, that other people were slowing down, you know, when there was a big exam, that other people were stopping. I really thought other people were drinking like I was. And my girls in my dorm had a thing where they said there was wasted, white girl wasted, and then Nora Allen wasted. And that was me. And I thought it was cool. I thought it was fun. I thought everyone else was doing things the way I was doing them. I didn't realize that people were starting to distance themselves from me because of the way I was drinking. I didn't realize that my relationships were falling apart. I didn't realize that my relationship with my parents had become very transactional. They would get a phone call that I was in the hospital. They would get a phone call that I needed money. They would get a phone call that something was going on with me. You know, it was always very one-sided. I really couldn't show up as a daughter. And things started to happen to me while I was drinking, as they do to alcoholics, and especially to female alcoholics. I would get myself into really bad situations, especially with men. And the guilt and shame and remorse of what happened to me while I was drinking would fuel another night of drinking, because I just wanted to blot the memory and the feelings out of my consciousness. I just wanted to turn my brain off so I didn't have to be in my body and be in my own skin. By my second semester of college, I nearly succeeded at ending my own life. I ended up in the psych ward, and I maintained to the techs at the hospital. I said, you know, I just had a really bad night. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I don't have a problem with anything else that was in my system. It was just a really bad night. And the professionals there, you know, the treatment facility I was in, they didn't have any AA. They didn't have any 12-step programs in that acute care unit. I don't know how my life would have been different if they had. And for that reason, today I'm very passionate about bringing in AA meetings to psychiatric facilities, because there are those of us, again, with those grave emotional and mental disorders that, you know, we need this message. We need this message being duly diagnosed, and you can run your life into the ground pretty quickly. But I got out of the treatment center, and I went to live with my dad in Pennsylvania at the time, which brought me here. And pretty quickly, I got in a relationship with somebody who was much older, who could get all the party goods I needed because I wasn't 21 yet. And it was one of those things where I would put aside any self-esteem, any self-respect to get what I needed. And pretty quickly, my habits started to progress to things other than alcohol. But for me, alcohol is what brought me to my knees. Alcohol is my Pandora's box key. You know, when I put a drink in me, I have no idea how my night is going to end. I don't know where I'm going to end up. I don't know when I'm going to stop. I can have all the best laid plans and precautions set in place to try and slow my drinking down, and they fail miserably every time. You know, being an alcoholic and being bodily and mentally different from my fellows, you know, that adage of the first drink gets you drunk, you know, it really does set off that phenomenon of craving. My cross-country teammates tried to have an intervention with me. I became more and more isolated. And pretty soon I was in a relationship with someone who had another substance problem, and I thought, if this person would just get well, if this person would just get it together, things would be better. One of the things that I don't always talk about in my story, but it's on my heart tonight, was when going into my senior year of college, my dad had gotten diagnosed with cancer, and I was more preoccupied with trying to get my mom to drink with me or get high with me before my dad's surgery instead of being a daughter in that moment, instead of being present. You know, my mom, who has a hard relationship with alcohol because it destroyed her childhood watching her parents, and yet when she just wanted her daughter to be there for her, all I could think about is I wanted a party buddy. That I couldn't be there for my parents. I couldn't wait to get back to school. I was out partying, you know, the day after his surgery, just running. Like, I couldn't show up. I couldn't be there. And fast forward a few years, you know, I'm constantly suicidal. If I'm not actively trying to end my life one way or another with substances or other means, I'm praying at night that I don't wake up in the morning. And when I do wake up, I'm cursing God that I'm still alive. You know, my drinking had become pretty regular at that point. Other substances were at play, but it was always alcohol. You know, it was always the bottle I went back to. I was convinced vodka didn't have a smell, but people could smell it on me. And one of the things I remember highlighting when I was first reading the Big Book was that paragraph about the ways we try to control our drinking, which does not occur in the temperate or moderate drinker. It's in the real alcoholic, the ways you try and control it, you try and switch your brand. I swore off of rum because rum made me wake up in weird people's beds. I thought I would switch to wine because wine was classy and elegant and refined and people drank it at parties. And pretty soon I'm drinking a freaking Mox and I'm throwing up and I'm sick in the morning. I'm saying I'm going to be the designated driver because if I'm the designated driver, I can't drink. Didn't work. I'm saying I'll go for a run before I'll make sure I have enough to eat. I'll make sure just this whole rigmarole of trying to control my drinking, and every time ending up so defeated, you know, I'm hitting it even harder. Like the whiskey and a glass of milk, you know, if I just contort it and twist it in this way and find this perfect formula, then maybe, just maybe, I'll be able to drink successfully and normally like my fellows. And the reality is when I'm honest with myself today, I never wanted to drink normally, socially, or casually because it didn't give me the effect that I needed. I'm in this relationship with this partner who's dealing with his drug addiction, trying to get well. I go to another 12-step fellowship because we just need to fix him. He needs to get clean. He needs to get his life together, and then we'll be fine. And lo and behold, I go there and they don't tell me, yeah, he's awful. He's awful. He's an addict. You know, they're like, hey, have you looked at you? And I said, not me. You know, I'm not doing those drugs. I'm drinking and doing some other things. I'll stop the other things, but I'll just drink because alcohol's legal and we'll be fine. And pretty soon we broke up. So great, that problem solved. I can just drink the way I want to. And it spiraled. You know, I really put myself on center stage on a pedestal just looking at the alcohol, and it was scary. My grandmother passed away in October of 2013, the one who had been an alcoholic, and I went to her wake with the mindset that I wasn't going to drink because I had to drive back to Pennsylvania that night. My parents were going to be there. And I had become very isolated from my parents. I would see them maybe a few days a year. I didn't want them to see the way I was drinking. My mom and my dad knew. They could tell. They didn't see me. They get calls all the time that I was in the hospital again. Things were suspicious. They knew about the psych ward. They knew about what was in my body, what my blood alcohol level was. So I was trying to hide my drinking from them. And I go to my grandmother's house, my late grandmother, and my uncles are there who drink the way I drank. And they said, let's just have a shot of Fireball. Single shot of Fireball can't hurt me. You know, I have every reason not to get drunk. I have every reason to keep it together. I know this about myself. I know if I drink two, then I start getting out of control, so I'll just have a single shot of Fireball. I'm an alcoholic. I take that first shot. I don't remember the second, third, fourth, eighth, ninth. I don't remember that night. I do know that I woke up. My mom had to drive me home. I was in a blackout. I made a scene at the wake. I proceeded to tell my father about all the things that had happened to me while I was drinking, things that a father never wanted to hear about his daughter. Selfish, self-centered, and afraid, you know, no way of dealing with my emotions, no way of being a daughter, no way of being a granddaughter, a friend, a niece in that moment, just an alcoholic in her cups. And my dad takes me aside the next morning. He said, you can't keep drinking. You know, you're destroying your body. I had already had some medical issues related to my drinking. And I'm looking him in the eyes and I'm like, yeah, I won't drink anymore. I won't drink anymore. And I knew I couldn't stop. I really still thought I had some semblance of control, that the self-knowledge would cure it. Self-knowledge would fix it. And I went on that little teeter-totter of trying to control the drinking again, of when I would stop and when I would start. And it snowballed. It snowballed to Christmas Eve of 2013, or Christmas, I'm sorry, of 2013. That week was a blur. I was at a family party with an ex, and I wanted to get drunk the way I needed to be at that place of comfort. And I couldn't get drunk. No matter how much I drank at the party, I couldn't get drunk. I start going through the medicine cabinet. I'm going through people's purses. I'm going through the fridge. I don't know half the people there, but all I need is something to get out of me and fast. And I can't do it. I can't get enough to get me to the point of where I want to be. It's Christmas. I don't have a car. I've been drinking. And my ex is yelling at me. He's like, Nora, it's Christmas. Can't you just give it a rest for one night? And I was like, no, I just need to get comfortable. I just need to get where I'm good. We got in a big fight. I went back to his parents' house and I woke up early the next morning, sick, as was my usual. And I Googled, am I an alcoholic? And I know a few things about alcoholism. I know a few things about alcohol and substance use disorder. I am a healthcare professional. I was in my internship and my training, and I was treating people with substance use disorder. I was treating people who had brain injuries as a result of using the drugs I was using. I had treated people who had cirrhosis, end-stage liver disease, esophageal varices, Wernicke's encephalopathy, which is wet brain, as a result of drinking. Looking at their intake histories, looking at how much they were drinking, looking at what they were doing, seeing myself, but trying to remove myself. Like, I'm not like them. I'm educated. I'm young. I'm a woman. I have this apartment. I have this boyfriend. I'm not homeless living under a bridge, so I'm not like them. And it's amazing how we can make ourselves so terminally unique, you know, when it comes to this program, how we're different, how we're better, you know, how we're so separate and apart from, but ultimately we were just out sitting in that rainstorm, watching it rain sideways and suffering as these little shells of ourselves. So I knew about 12-step programs. I woke up my boyfriend at the time and I said, hey, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, yeah, I know. He was on the verge of breaking up with me and I had no idea. Maybe because every time we went to a bar, I told people he wanted to fight them. Maybe every time we would try and get a bottle of wine, I needed three so he could have a glass and I could have the other bottles. I did not realize, you know, that I was at that point of the fatal progression. You know, I had gone past that near habit. You know, I just couldn't see it. And I went to my first ever AA meeting over at Chestnut Street in Emmaus. And I remember hearing them read out of the big book and talking about the young person who's scarcely more than a potential alcoholic. And I got really excited. I said, I'm a potential alcoholic. I'm not the real thing. I nipped it in the bud. I'm good. I'm good. And something happened that night. You know, what this book tells us to do, you know, when you meet a new person is to share your own experience, to share the language of the heart, to be able to say what it was like, what their experience was. And this person told me her story. And her story, in my head, I was like, wait a second, if she's an alcoholic, she's not nearly where I've been, you know, and going through what I've been through, then maybe I do need this thing. So they had said to me, what meeting are you going to tomorrow? And, you know, that began the real start for me for jumping into AA. And I started coming to meetings and people are talking about step work and sponsorship. And I'm thinking in my head, yeah, okay, maybe eventually, you know, well, I didn't have a DUI. I wasn't in rehab, you know, all these things that hadn't happened to me that I was hearing in other people's stories, you know, comparing myself out instead of comparing in. And somebody told me there's a magic word called yet. You're eligible to. any of those things that didn't happen to me are still liable to happen if I want to try some more controlled drinking. You know, and I see it. I've stayed around for a few 24s now, and I've seen it, that those consequences, they're still out there, and they can certainly still happen, you know, if I choose to rest on my laurels, if I choose to, you know, let up on the spiritual growth and the principles of this program. And I did get a sponsor, and I started to see some things about myself going through the process of my steps. One thing I was really convinced was that I hadn't hurt anyone with my drinking. You know, I really drank at home. Like, towards the end, I became a hermit. You know, I stayed in my house because when I was drinking in bars, they didn't make my drinks fast enough. I would end up bringing in a water bottle full of vodka to make my drink stronger. life hack, no. I was doing that. I mean, I didn't want to pay for all the drinks. I didn't want to have to share my alcohol if I was going to a party. So I started drinking at home, and I became this hermit. And somebody brought up the concept to me of the fact of stealing, you know, that I had stole peace of mind from my parents, that I had stole a daughter from my parents, a sister from my sister, an employee from my employers. You know, I was not a reliable employee. I was getting high in the freezer. I was showing up drunk from the night before, if I was showing up at all. I was constantly sick. My professors were convinced I had narcolepsy, because that seemed like an appropriate way to excuse my falling asleep in class. You know, realizing how I had robbed people of the person that they deserved in their lives. And I really realized just how selfish and self-centered I had been when I started doing a fourth and a fifth step and getting an honest look at myself. One of the other big things for me was fear and realizing how I was just as afraid of getting the things I wanted as I was of not getting them. You know, being in that awful paradox of fear. And something that I'm really working on today in sobriety is taking a deeper look at 1, 2, and 3. Because when I came in with step 1, it was all about, you know, being able to admit I was an alcoholic and powerless over alcohol, looking at the unmanageability of my life. And I could accept that. I could accept that when I came in because I could see it. When I finally put it down on paper, when I started reading the big book, reading more about alcoholism and being able to highlight the whole chapter because it described me to a T. But the longer I'm sober, it's not about the drink. The longer I'm sober, it's more about my think. It's more about my mind. It's more about, you know, what I'm still trying to control, what I still am powerless over, but I'm fighting to prove I have some semblance of power about, you know. And for me, emotional sobriety has been about these deeper surrenders. So starting initially with alcohol, you know, and looking at a higher power, I really made a real small beginning with steps 2 and 3 because I had this God of my childhood, which I thought was sufficient, you know, and the book tells you it really just has to be a beginning. You know, what I started with was the rooms, the group of drunks was God, because I would come to these rooms and there was something here that I didn't have in myself. But all of you, you know, you guys gave me peace of mind. You guys gave me a sense of ease and comfort, kind of like the bottle did. But I wasn't waking up sick. I wasn't waking up with people mad at me. So I figured if I kept coming, maybe, just maybe, something else would happen for me. And when I started again working on step 4, the fears, the resentments, I just started to see more about myself, you know, in step 5 and my character defects and where they had brought me, how they had worked for me and how they had ultimately then failed me and turned on me. You know, the things that had become survival instincts, like manipulating people so they would buy my alcohol. But then ultimately realizing, you know, it wasn't a sober way to live. You know, I didn't have true relationships. I didn't have true friendships because they were transactional. And to start to develop a true partnership with another human being, there had to be a sense of honesty. There had to be a sense of just genuine goodwill, which I didn't have before. And I did go on to do a 4th step and a 5th step looking specifically at sex conduct, because that was another area of my life when I came in, which was an absolute disaster. It was something I was powerless over. It was something, I used relationships and sex like I used alcohol and drugs. You know, it was an escape. It was something I could use to get outside of my own head. It was something I could use to make me feel better. And it was something that could destroy my life in a matter of seconds. You know, being so hinged on approval, being so hinged on transactions and things like that. So really getting thorough and honest, like it lays out in the fourth step, is related to sex conduct. You know, what had happened, you know, what I should have done differently, the true nature of things. You know, seeing what parts of self had I aroused bitterness, jealousy, suspicion, looking at those things, and then making an ideal and actually earnestly and honestly praying on that. Earnestly and honestly, yes, wanting to seek a partner who was honest, who was kind, who was spiritual, who was sober, but recognizing I had to be those things myself. And I had never looked for something like that in a relationship before. It really was, what could you do for me? What do you have that I need? Instead, I took the tact of starting to look at what can I bring to a relationship with another human. And it started with looking at the sex ideal, but it also has blossomed into looking at my relationships at work, my friendships, any areas of my life. Well, how are those relationships going? You know, what am I bringing to the table versus what am I expecting out of another person? And really praying and bringing God into the situation, you know, admitting powerlessness, surrendering, asking to God to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I got pretty miraculous results. But again, it continues to be a process for me today, looking at 1, 2, and 3. What do I continue to be powerless over? And what am I continuing to surrender? What am I allowing God to take over in my life? Because I can still go back to that life run on self-will. I can still go back to that life where I'm getting my own results, you know, prey to bitterness, misery, depression. If I'm not actively working these steps, if I'm not actively using these principles and applying them in my life. 8 and 9 in making an amends. There's always those people on your list that, you know, you're like, yeah, no, never. I'll never make an amends to that person. You know, but some of the experiences I've had that have really been transformational for me have been the ones that were the most difficult to make. You know, I did have ones where people didn't want to see me, people didn't want to hear from me, and they became living amends. And those are sometimes some of the most important ones in my life today. You know, the people that I'll never be able to see face to face, the people that I may never be able to make a direct amends to, but I'm willing to if they're open and the opportunity presents itself. But really focusing on my own part and being willing to make things right. 10, 11, and 12 have been nothing short of incredible in my life today. Bill Wilson talks about taking on their own when it comes to self-examination, meditation, and prayer. On their own can be of great benefit, but when woven together, build an unshakable foundation for life. And I hit a point when I was 2 years sober. I had been through the steps. This is where I really hit the wall with my relationships with the opposite sex. And when I talked to my sponsor at that time and I was going through where I was at with my program and what I was doing, I was really doing a two-step. I was really doing step 1 and step 12. I wasn't drinking and I was going to meetings. I wasn't really carrying the message or passing the program on because I didn't have much to pass on at that point. I was back in self again, you know, acting out, misbehaving, not drinking, but pretty emotionally dry and brittle. And thank God I had the deep breath, the surrender, the moment where I looked at myself, I asked for help, and I got it. And one thing that was really missing was that regular self-examination. You know, they tell us that we alcoholics are undisciplined, so we have a simple way that God has outlined in these steps. And when I started actually utilizing the process of self-examination, whether it was in the moment, whether it was on a nightly basis, or even in the morning, like thinking ahead, you know, my plans for the day, bringing God into my plans for the day, everything started to change. I brought God back into my life. God was there the whole time. You know, I'd had an experience with a higher power, but I wasn't really allowing my higher power to be my higher power. My higher power had become other people. My higher power had become validation, acceptance, sex, anything other than a true loving higher power. And it's a painful place to be. But by utilizing the tools of that self-examination, the prayer, and then really genuinely putting myself out there and making a conscious effort to be of service to other alcoholics, to actually put my hand out to the newcomer, to be willing to sponsor women, even if women weren't looking for a sponsor, just becoming a contact in the program, someone they could talk to, someone that they could to be a sober support, those things changed my sobriety drastically. And they continue to be the strong foundation for me today, you know, 10, 11, and 12. And I can forget. I can get comfortable. I can get complacent. But if I'm letting up on 10, 11, and 12, sooner or later, I'm going to feel it. You know, if I'm not actively thinking of how I can be of service to the next person inside and outside the rooms, if I'm not actively utilizing the inventory tool or the prayer, I get those effects. I get my own results. Like I said, I'm working on 1, 2, and 3 again in a different aspect, in a different light in my life today. Really seeing where there's still powerlessness, where I'm still wrestling with some semblance of control for one reason or another, and it's usually fear. There's a deeper fear underneath it. I've had the pleasure, and I can actually say that today, I've had the pleasure of doing a few different fourth steps with a few different sponsors, and every single one has given me something that I needed. Every single one has given me, you know, a valuable perspective with the literature, with the work, with the steps. And I've brought a different woman to that table. I've brought a different woman to that inventory, where I've been at, where I've had the growth. I've realized, you know, there's certain resentments sometimes you have. There's some that are pebbles and there's some that are boulders. The pebbles, maybe I can get rid of them with a nightly review and checking in with a sponsor. Maybe I can do a thorough fourth step and it's removed. The boulders, I chunk away at. The boulders, I get them piece by piece. And I've had those resentments that when I came in, I was sick. When I came in, I had really dark thoughts about other people. And today, you know, those boulders have melted away, you know, through continued prayer, through continued action, through continued patience, love, and tolerance of other people. Finding patience, love, and tolerance of myself. That was another part of this program that my first sponsor had said to me too when I was making my my list of resentments. She said, "Who's the first person on your list?" I said, "My ex-boyfriend." And she said, "No." So my mom, definitely my mom. And she said, "No, it's not your mom." I said, "Well, those are the top two." And she said, "It's you, you know, resentment towards yourself." And I said, "Yeah, that doesn't really make sense." And then I did start to realize it when I started to write about how much self-loathing and self-hatred I had. Any semblance of self-confidence had just disappeared over the years. You know, incomprehensible demoralization is what the book talks about. And to me, that's showering with the lights off because I don't even want to look at my own body after what happened to me the night before. To me, that's, you know, picking up the pieces of where I've been and who's been around me. To me, that's the hopelessness of knowing that I want to stop and I can't, you know, and hating myself for it. But realizing, like, as long as I'm still hating myself, I can't begin to start loving anyone else. And the beauty of these steps and the way they're outlined is they connect us back to a higher power. They connect us back to ourselves and they connect us back to other people. You know, to me, so much of the steps and the principles that are in them are about rebuilding relationships. Some of us sometimes come in with religious or other preconceived notions about a power greater than ourselves. And I really like what it talks about in Appendix 2 about the spiritual experience and not allowing, you know, contempt prior to investigation to keep us from having a spiritual experience, to keep us from seeing the power of that in our lives. And like I said, I made that slow beginning when I came in with the group of drunks, with people in the rooms. And the one thing I started to experience was a sense of comfort and peace of mind that I never had. And it's nothing short of remarkable to me that as the years go by, as I'm continuing to utilize this program, as I'm continuing to practice the principles and trying to have a deeper experience, how deep that experience can go. You know, this program is contingent upon, you know, spiritual maintenance on a daily basis. I was listening to, you know, a speaker tape today, and he said, it doesn't matter that you were a GSR 2 years ago. It doesn't matter that you chaired your home group last month. It doesn't matter that, you know, you did a fourth step once. You know, what am I doing today for my recovery? And that's something that I try to keep at the forefront of my mind. I try to keep, you know, how can I be a copy of the big book that other people may never get a chance to see? And I've had some pretty remarkable moments as a result of being a sober woman today. I had an experience. I was at an event in my professional life, and you know, it's amazing when I go places and there's an open bar and it doesn't even cross my mind that alcohol's there. You know, that I can just say, yeah, I'm good. I'm having seltzer. I'm having whatever else. And there was somebody else there, who was drinking, and I had offered them a ride, and come to find out this person had been a member of our fellowship and had gotten away from it, and was actively suffering. And I was able to make a really special connection by carrying this message, by being actively in the principles, you know. And I have a beautiful relationship with that person today, you know, because I'm able to be open, you know, the language of the heart that this book talks about, where, you know, we share precisely that. It becomes our greatest asset. You know, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That continues to be an asset. I think we live in a world today where so many people have been touched by this disease, whether it's in themselves or it's people they love in their lives. And to be able to share the message of hope, that is recovery, that is happy, purposeful, useful lives, from a place of such darkness and despair, you know, we owe it. We owe it to share it. We owe it to pay it forward. It's a beautiful thing. I'm very involved in service today to the best of my ability, because I can't even begin to say what I get back from what I put into my program. I know what it's like to rest on your laurels. I know what it's like to get complacent. I know what it's like to get spiritually bland. But continuing to be willing to grow along spiritual lines, be willing to continue to have a new experience, it's a powerful and beautiful thing. And the only, just as there's no bottom to which how low your bottom can get. If you go back out and your bottom gets lower, there's no bottom to that, other than maybe dying. There's no bottom to it. But there's no ceiling to spiritual growth. There's no ceiling to the hope and the promises in this program. And, you know, we talk about the promises a lot, but the thing is they're related with doing the ninth step. They're related with doing 1 through 9 and living in 10, 11, and 12 for those things to come true in your life. I started out by saying how I was so full of fear, and how that became my internal drugstore, that was where I was plugged. That's where my head was constantly. And one of the most miraculous results of my life today is comprehending the word serenity and knowing peace. You know, I knew nothing like peace. I couldn't sit alone with myself. I couldn't be quiet with myself. I was constantly going. I was constantly fearing the next thing. And to be able to have peace, to comprehend the word serenity and to know peace, to be able to invite my higher power into any given situation, you know, sobriety, as much as it brings a lot of beautiful things and a lot of promises, it's still life. There's still pain. There's still loss. There's still unsurmountable circumstances that can and do happen to us. But the miracle of this program is the ability to do the next right thing. The ability of this program is the freedom from the obsession to drink. You know, old circumstances where you might have certainly said to yourself, well, this is a good excuse as any to drink. Today, to have no reservations, is for your head to not even go there. You know, to pick up the phone before you pick a drink, to hit your knees before you hit the bar, to have that obsession removed. That's incredible. I remember driving in early sobriety and being terrified of looking towards the liquor store because I thought my car would just go if I was looking. Not being able to travel because I couldn't possibly get all the things I needed to feel well on my trips. But being able to go places, being able to act in good purpose today, it's nothing short of a miracle, and it's nothing short of a gift of this program. I am so grateful for that, and I'm so grateful for all of you guys. Thank you.